But now Bill Riznick leads off with the second part of an interview with Judge Wynn Alderman of the Eastern District of Wisconsin, who wrote an article about to appear in the Journal of the Very Liberal American Constitution Society, titled "The Roberts Court Assault on Democracy." Bill?
This is Cable Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Riznick here for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm talking to Judge Lynn Alderman of the Eastern District of Wisconsin. He's written an article, "The Roberts Court Assault on Democracy." We've discussed so far their decisions on voting rights, talking about their approval of gerrymandering, of purges of voters that hit black and liberal voters the hardest, as well as the destruction of the Voting Rights Act that called for a pre-clearance of any voting rights law in areas that had historically discriminated. And once they got rid of that law, saying it was a relic of the past, Texas and many other places, as Judge Alderman discussed, they immediately reinstated laws that were discriminatory. Tell us about how do you approach that issue?
Well, in writing about democracy, I thought it was important not only to talk about voting rights. The voting rights is obviously a fundamental to democracy, but it's And as I've talked about some of the court's decisions in that area already, and there's more. There's a recent decision in which the court washed its hands of partisan gerrymandering, which really dilutes the effect of people's votes. It basically, it allows state legislatures to gerrymander legislatures in favor of one party, and people who are not of that party, then their votes are pretty much made worthless. But there's also another part of it, of the decisions of the court, that I wanted to talk about, and those had to do with wealth and inequality, because we're all aware of the increasing inequality in the United States and the changes that have occurred since maybe the 1950s and 60s, when when unions were much stronger and there was a much larger and more well-paid sort of working class and middle class. And as unions have become less powerful, and as a fairly small number of people, sometimes called the 1%, have become very, very wealthy, our society has become much more stratified and much more unequal. And everyone is aware of this. And highly unequal societies have really serious problems just by the fact that there's such a huge gap between rich and poor. I mean, there's no doubt that political power follows economic power. And when you have a small number of people that are very powerful economically, they also have very great political power. And this is the people talk about oligarchy, and that's sort of one of the characteristics of an oligarchy. And they also, highly unequal societies have slower economic growth than equal societies or more equal societies. Huge economic inequality creates all kinds of problems: health problems, lower life expectancies, higher infant mortality rates, higher rates of mental illness. Inequality is associated with all kinds of social problems, including lower rates of trust, lower social cohesion, and higher rates of violent crime. So my interest in this part of the story was to ask if the Roberts Court was doing anything to perhaps counteract some of the trends that we see in our political economy. And I noted that in the 50s and 60s, the Warren Court did play a kind of a very positive role in dealing with some of our problems that are sort of similar. For example, the Warren Court addressed the problem of racial segregation, which was inconsistent with democracy, and it addressed the problem of reapportionment, which was also really antithetical to democracy. It addressed some of the problems of a very unfair criminal justice system. And so I think it would be desirable for the present Supreme Court to do something analogous. But in fact, what I think it's been doing is sort of reinforcing the economic and political inequality that we see going on just by virtue of the way the economy works. Probably the best example of that is the campaign finance decisions, which really the First Amendment has been kind of interpreted in such a way that people with wealth can virtually give all kinds of contributions, and that's held by the court to be their free speech right, where almost any attempt by a democratically elected legislature to put limits on campaign contributions or independent expenditures or to provide sort of public financing efforts in order to try to equal the playing field, all those kinds of initiatives by legislatures have been questioned by the Supreme Court because of their very narrow interpretation of the First Amendment.
Yeah, they've also strengthened corporate power a whole lot. You mentioned the decisions that undermine unions, decisions that make it more and more difficult for people to band together in class actions, decisions that, and these are all reversals, actually, of prior precedent that have been found to be perfectly constitutional. And they also approved arbitration agreements which force employees to get a job. You have to sign an agreement that if you have any grievances against the company, it goes to arbitration rather than to the courts. And, of course, the arbitration system is a lot quicker, cheaper, and also the companies have a big role in choosing the judges and influencing the judges. Not to say that they don't have a big role in influencing other judges as well, but all of those things work against sort of ordinary people being able to having the capacity to actually challenge. Give us an example of one of those where they're, how the court has dealt with it.
Well, I guess one of the more obvious ones is this is the famous Citizens United case, which was a campaign finance case, which basically extended to corporations the power to spend money on campaigns. And really, that, you know, that's in, spending money on campaigns is not really part of why corporations exist. And that decision has sort of justly achieved a great deal of notoriety and opposition. Another example might be this sort of little-known Sorrell case in Vermont. The case, I guess, is called Sorrell versus IMS Healthcare, and involved a Vermont statute which prohibited pharmacies from selling data regarding prescriptions without affirmative consent from the prescribing physicians. The idea was a couple things. One, to protect the privacy of physicians so that they weren't bombarded by drug companies trying to get them to promote their particular product. And also it had to do with privacy. It was a right to privacy issue. And also an effort to reduce the cost of health care by curbing disproportionate sale of expensive drugs. So this law was a totally legitimate attempt by the legislature to accomplish some socially beneficial purposes. The law exempted academic researchers and nonprofits because they did not pose the same problem as representatives from the pharmaceutical industry. And then the court, in another 5-4 decision, struck this down, saying this distinction was not a rational response to a marketplace structured by forces that give profit-seeking actors particular incentives, but it was legislative interference with the marketplace. You know, in the view of the Roberts Court, the marketplace is by definition a kind of a benign space. And the Vermont legislature, again, a democratically elected body, was sort of interfering with the market by discriminating against particular speakers who were pharmaceutical marketers. So, I mean, it just, first of all, it's an amazing use of the First Amendment. And then they did that in one of the cases you mentioned, the case about, it's called Janus, and that's the case that had to do with public employee unions being able to charge what they call agency fees to people who are not members of the union but who benefited from the collective bargaining agreements that, were negotiated by the union. And as you said, that had been on the books, had been approved by the Supreme Court 40 years ago. Well, another 5-4 decision, they struck that down. And then you also mentioned an arbitration case. And there, you know, they upheld the power of a company to basically say that a new employee had to agree to not be part of a class action challenging any kind of wages or conditions of employment, and that those had to go to arbitration if that's what the agreement said. All these decisions basically make it harder for working people, and they sort of reinforce this economic inequality that I talked about earlier. So instead of kind of intervening in a more positive way to kind of offset the trends toward the anti-democratic trends toward economic inequality, the court here is, and in other cases, is reinforcing it. The same is true with the way they treat poor people. This well, there's the famous Obamacare case in which the court upheld the Affordable Care Act, at least part of it, the more famous part of it. But there was a part of it that the court struck down. See, Congress wanted to provide health care to as many people as possible. And so the way they dealt with poor people was that they expanded Medicaid. And Medicaid is a federal program, but it's administered by the states. And basically, in the expansion of Medicaid statute in the Affordable Care Act, Congress agreed to pay for the, I think, 90% or 100% for the first 3 years and 90% thereafter, something like that. It was clear that Congress was footing the bill for virtually the entire cost of the service. And the Roberts Court, this is now by 7-2. This is not only a 5-4 vote, and that's also disturbing for other reasons. But anyway, they struck that down, saying that it violated the spending clause of the U.S. Constitution because it coerced states into participating in this program that the court distinguished from previous Medicaid programs. So the effect of that now has been that many, many people, I mean, I think there's still some 17 or 18 states that have, including Wisconsin, where I live, that have refused to participate in the expanded program. So the poor people in those states, and most of the states are in the old Confederacy, so there's a large number of African Americans who are disadvantaged by a state's refusal to participate in this program. And so that's what's happened, is that if they had upheld that, if they had left that alone, that law alone that Congress passed, then all these poor people would have health insurance. But now millions don't have it because they said that Congress couldn't tell the states to do this. And there's a large number of African Americans that are disadvantaged, and it's had a huge effect on people's health. In some of the states where there's still fairly large number of deaths from AIDS, almost all of those deaths could have been prevented had there been Medicaid available to those victims. So I just think it seems this is another way in which the court is really reinforcing economic and political trends that are harmful, rather than stepping in and trying to reinforce more democratic kinds of approaches.
You know, one, there was another case that it seems to me deserves attention. It was shocking to me reading your article. The case that came again out of Texas.
Oh, you're talking about the San Antonio School District case?
Yeah, that was where state aid to rich districts is like $1,000 per student, and state aid to poor districts is like $370 per student. And the what was it, legislation that in fact forced the state of Texas to equalize the amount of money given per student, and that was struck down by, this was the Burger Court apparently, not the Roberts Court, but the Roberts Court and the Rehnquist Courts, none of them ever touched that. It's a shocking decision.
Yeah, it was San Antonio versus San Antonio Independent School District versus Rodriguez. This goes back to 1973, and it sort of presaged some of these Roberts Court decisions that I've been talking about. It was a 5-4 decision, again, the conservative majority, and they upheld a school financing system in Texas in which for every $1,000 that the state sent wealthy districts, it sent only $370 to poor districts. And the court basically said that students in public schools had no constitutional right to an equal public education. And there was an eloquent dissent by the great Justice Thurgood Marshall, who receives much less recognition than he's entitled to. He argued that the government had to treat all citizens equally, and he questioned how the judiciary in a democracy that was supposedly committed to equality could uphold the system. He noted that the discriminatory expenditures at issue seriously impaired the ability of the poor to participate effectively in society, because there's obviously a close connection between education and political participation, which is the heart of citizenship. So this was a long time ago, but I think it's important to note that since the Warren Court ended, which was I think in 1970 or right around there, we've had now 50 years of courts dominated by conservatives, and the San Antonio School District case really was a kind of a marker, and that basically commenced a tradition that's been going on for 50 years of many cases in which economic inequality is not supported by the court.
This is KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM. Bill Resnick here talking to Judge Lynn Edelman of the Eastern District of Wisconsin, who's written an article, The Roberts Court Assault on Democracy, which also talks about the whole conservative, starting with the Burger Court, the Rehnquist Court, now the Roberts Court, increasingly radical conservative decisions supporting corporate and rich people's power and undermining the both voting rights and the kind of equality and creating precariousness among the poor that undermine their capacity to actually participate in making any kind of decision that might offend their corporate powers. Judge Edelman, what's your sense of how the court could be somehow changed towards interpreting the constitutions in ways that create equality and provide for the kind of life experiences and income and possibilities that make for the popular classes to be able to really participate in the conditions of their life and not be dominated by their economic needs? And the question, of course, is how do we change the U.S. Supreme Court?
Well, I think the only thing that we can do really is to try to build a lot of popular support for more progressive positions. I think that would do a couple things. One, if we elected presidents who had different views of how these issues should be resolved, that would lead to a different kind of judicial appointments. But also, I do think that the courts pay attention to public opinion, and I think the courts do not want to be seen as outliers, as completely opposing progress. I mean, I think that the New Deal showed that. There's that famous saying about one of the justices who had previously been quite negative on some of the Roosevelt New Deal initiatives changed his views, and that led to the saying, a switch in time saved nine. The idea that that protected the court. I just think that the courts are mindful of how public feels. And I think Chief Justice Roberts is very interested in having the court not be perceived as overly political. So if there's a very strong feelings on the public, I think that that would have an effect.
Judge Lynn Edelman, thanks so much for talking to us today.
It's been a pleasure, Bill. Appreciate your inviting me.
Keep up the good work.
Sail on, sail on, old man, dear ship of state, to the shores of Eve, past the reefs of greed, through the smiles of hate. Sail on. Sail on, sail on. It's coming to America first, the cradle of the best and of the worst. It's here they got the range and the machinery for change, and it's here they got the spiritual thirst. It's here the family's broken, and it's here the lonely say that the heart has got to open in a fundamental way. Democracy is coming to the USA.